Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. This is your host, Reka Anna Horvath, and today I'm happy to welcome Bobby Charail, the author of The Logic of Immunity, Deciphering an Enigma. This book appeared very recently, in the January of 2024, and Bobby is a associate professor and a physician scientist at the Harvard Medical School. So Bobby, welcome to the show, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Reka. It's really a privilege to be on your program. As you said, I am on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, as well as directing a lab at Massachusetts General Hospital. And my lab studies the early phases of the immune response to bacterial infection in the gastrointestinal tract.
And your book has a much broader scope than this. It actually gives a great overview of this whole fascinating and complex system. So can you tell us a bit about your motivation? Why did you decide to write such a book?
Yes, so the motivation actually came from two experiences. The first is that I have been teaching in a basic immunology course in India and South Africa for many years. And as a result, I have accumulated several lectures that I have been delivering to the audiences there. And that experience convinced me that there was a real need for a book that explained immunology at a simpler level than is found in most standard textbooks on the subject. So that was in the back of my mind, but I never had the time to actually convert my lectures into a manuscript. But then when the COVID-19 pandemic started, we were forced to stay at home for about 3 months. We weren't allowed to go to the lab. So I had a lot of time on my hands and I started writing the manuscript and then continued writing once we were allowed to go back to the lab and finally finished the manuscript about a year or a year and a half later and was fortunate enough to find a publisher fairly soon after that.
Well, congratulations. I think it is a really amazing overview of this system. And COVID was a funny timing in other way as well, because I think many of us got more interested in the immune system during that period. So probably most of us have always appreciated that it's very important. But now we learned also more about, we got more interested in learning how it actually works. And that's exactly what the book describes really well. And that is going to be our main topic for today. So I would like to start with it at the very beginning, that how does an immune response get started? How do immune cells recognize a pathogen?
It's a very good question, Reka. So as you may remember from your reading of the book, the immune response is broadly divided into two distinct phases. The earliest phase, which occurs within minutes to hours of sensing a problem, and then that is called innate immunity or the innate immune component of the response. And then subsequently, there's a second phase known as adaptive immunity or the adaptive immune phase of the response. And both these components of the immune system have distinct ways of recognizing that there is a problem or recognizing the presence of a pathogen and the need to mount a response. So in the case of the innate immunity or the innate immune system, the way in which the response is initiated is by the recognition of molecules that are present relatively specifically on microorganisms and not present on mammalian cells, that is the cells of our own body. So just to give you an example, many bacteria have on their surface a molecule called lipopolysaccharide. So the recognition of lipopolysaccharide by cells of the innate immune system indicates the presence of a microorganism where it should not be. And that triggers a signal that initiates responses that help to eliminate that microorganism. Now, the sensing of lipopolysaccharide and other similar molecules is carried out by specific receptor proteins present on the surface of cells of the innate immune system, such as macrophages, neutrophils, epithelial cells, and so on. So the binding of lipopolysaccharide to the receptor on these cells, and this receptor, this particular receptor, is known as toll-like receptor 4. So the binding of lipopolysaccharide to toll-like receptor 4 initiates signals within the cell that then bring about various responses from the cell and other cells that are recruited to the site of the infection.
Thanks for this great explanation. And I would like to encourage the readers to check out in chapter 3 the description of how this PSTLR mechanism was discovered. Now, can we perhaps take a step back and can you explain to us what exactly a receptor is?
So the receptor is a general term that describes a molecule that is able to interact with another molecule called a ligand. And that ligand-receptor interaction activates signals that lead to a change in the properties or the behavior of the cell that is being triggered in that fashion. Now, receptors are often proteins, but they can be other types of molecules also. And receptors are often expressed on the surface of the cell, where they are able to detect the presence of the ligands in the environment around the cell.
Thanks. That's a great description. And also there is a great figure 3.2 in the book where we can see an immune cell of the innate immune system and various receptors both on the surface and also within the cell, and how it these different receptors can recognize different molecular patterns. So my next question is, what happens afterwards? Let's say a ligand has bound to a receptor. What's next?
Very good question. So the binding of the ligand to the receptor activates an intracellular signaling cascade. And when I say signaling cascade, what I usually mean, what I refer to is the fact that the binding of the ligand to the receptor causes changes in the configuration of the receptor that allows it to interact with other proteins inside the cell. And that interaction in turn can cause changes in that protein, which then allows that second protein to interact with another protein. And so you have this propagation of signals from the surface of the cell initiated by a binding of the ligand to the receptor. And then a series of events that occur downstream of that event, and then usually culminate in a change in the expression of various genes. In the case of the innate immune cells, these genes are involved in activating mechanisms that help to kill the bacterium that has initiated this whole series of events, and to bring about the recruitment of other immune cells from the circulation to the site of the infection where the bacterium was initially detected. So this is basically a signaling pathway, a cascade of events that culminates in changes in gene expression and cell behavior, and at a broader level, changes in the kind of cell that are brought into the environment or called into the environment where this signaling cascade was initiated.
Okay, so just to verify that I understand correctly, first there are changes within the cell after the ligand binding, and because of the changes of gene expression, some kind of protein gets released by that cell, and that in turn leads to further cells being activated, perhaps because their receptors also bind that.
That is absolutely correct. That one of the consequences of this signaling pathway is the release of various molecules into the environment of the cell, and those molecules in turn can activate other receptors on other cells in the vicinity, and thereby bring about additional changes that contribute to the innate immune response. And one aspect of this innate immune response is what we call inflammation, which is the recruitment of various cells from the circulation into the site of the infection, and that we often recognize by the accompanying changes, the redness, the warmth, the swelling that we often experience, for instance, when we injure our finger and that injury becomes contaminated with bacteria, and we feel these symptoms, the redness, the warmth, the swelling, and perhaps the pain, that are all a manifestation of the inflammatory response that is triggered by the recognition of bacterial ligands by receptors such as toll-like receptor 4.
One thing which I found very interesting is that there are many, many such pathogens, and there are many different patterns which they express. Can you tell a bit more about that?
Sure. So lipopolysaccharide is one example of a bacterial molecule that can be recognized by specific receptors on innate immune cells. But there are many other such molecules. Collectively, these molecules are called pathogen-associated molecular patterns, or PAMPs. And there are many PAMPs that can be recognized by specific receptors on innate immune cells. So lipopolysaccharide is one that is recognized by toll-like receptor 4. Another bacterial component is a carbohydrate or a sugar-like molecule that is a component of all bacterial cell walls. So this is a component known as peptidoglycan. That can also be recognized by other related receptors. So another member of the toll-like receptor family, known as TLR1 and TLR2, there are certain bacteria express a protein known as flagellin, which is a component of the structure that allows the bacteria to move around in their environment. And flagellin can be recognized by another receptor of the toll-like receptor family, known as toll-like receptor 5. There are also other receptors, and these are collectively known as pattern recognition receptors, the receptors that recognize PAMPs, that are able to recognize components of viruses or protozoan parasites, and so on. So collectively, the pattern recognition receptors that our innate immune cells express are able to recognize a wide variety of microbes. In effect, most of the microbial pathogens that our bodies might be infected by, their components, their molecules, or their PAMPs can be recognized by several different types of pattern recognition receptors expressed on cells of our innate immune system.
Thanks. That was a great overview. And if somebody wants a visual overview, I recommend checking out figure 3.1 in the third chapter, where we can see bacteria, fungi, and viruses, and so various types of pathogens, and what kind of molecular patterns they do have. So what you have just described in words, we can see some nice pictures there as well. So besides these pathogen-associated patterns, there are also some other patterns, the damage-associated ones. How do these come into the picture during an immune response?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
So, repeat. besides the pathogen-associated molecular patterns, there are some other patterns that immune cells recognize and react to. These are the damage-associated patterns.
Yes.
How do these come into the picture during an immune response?
Very good question. So in addition to the recognition of PAMPs, pathogen-associated molecular patterns by pattern recognition receptors of the innate immune system, the pattern recognition receptors also have the ability to recognize a second class of molecule. These are called damage-associated molecular patterns, or DAMPs. And these are molecules that are normally present only inside cells and never present outside the cell. But when a cell becomes damaged, then these molecules leak out from the inside of the cell into the space outside the cell. And so when such DAMPs that are released into the external environment are recognized by the appropriate pattern recognition receptors, that essentially indicates to the innate immune cells that there are damaged cells in the vicinity. And the damaged cells require the innate immune system to respond in a way to control that damage. And since this damage can often occur in the context of an infection, this is also another way in which microbial invasion can be sensed. So microbes can be sensed both by the PAMPs that they themselves express, but also by the fact that these microbes can cause cell damage, leading to the release of DAMPs, which can also trigger pattern recognition receptors and initiate a response to control the infection and to take care of the damage.
So is it fair to say that the recognition via PAMPs is the direct recognition of the microbes, and the recognition via DAMPs is the indirect one, where it's not the microbe which gets recognized, but the damage caused by the microbes, let's say?
That is absolutely correct. So PAMPs allow direct recognition of the microbe, and DAMPs allow recognition in an indirect fashion based on the damage caused by the microbial infection. But it is also important to point out that DAMPs can be released even in the absence of microbial infection. So, for instance, during surgery, or if you happen to twist your ankle during a fall, that can also lead to tissue and cell damage and the release of DAMPs that elicit or activate an innate immune response, including inflammation. So if you have ever fallen and twisted your ankle, you will see that the ankle becomes red, warm, and swollen and painful, all indicators of the inflammation that is triggered by the release of DAMPs from the damaged cells.
And so far, everything we have discussed was part of the innate immune system, this first part of the response. Can you perhaps tell us a bit about the second part, the adaptive immune system, and about the similarities and differences between these two?
Sure. So the innate immune system has some limitations. So the pattern recognition receptors used by cells of the innate immune system recognize broad classes of PAMPs and DAMPs. So for instance, the pattern toll-like receptor 4 is unable to distinguish the lipopolysaccharide present on one type of bacterium from lipopolysaccharide present on another type of bacterium, even though there are clear structural differences. So the pattern recognition receptors have a broad specificity of recognition. They also tend to elicit or activate very similar types of responses. These limitations may sometimes allow microbes to find ways to evade innate immune responses. So we usually require a more sophisticated system in order to completely eliminate the infection. And that more sophisticated response is carried out by the adaptive immune system. Now, the adaptive immune system has two main types of cells that are involved. They are called lymphocytes broadly, but there are two different types known as B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes, named for their origin in the bone marrow and the thymus, respectively. Now, B lymphocytes are specialized to secrete antibodies that are able to eliminate infection in various ways. And T lymphocytes carry out complementary functions by other mechanisms that we can get to later if we have the time. Now, the wonderful thing about lymphocytes and the adaptive immune system is that they have the ability to recognize almost an infinite variety of molecules. Okay. So they are not restricted in the kinds of molecules that they can recognize. And the B and T cells have the ability to carry out very fine discrimination between even structurally similar types of molecules. And this recognition of such molecules, which are referred to as antigens in the context of adaptive immunity, is carried out by specific receptor proteins on the surface of B and T lymphocytes that are referred to as the B cell antigen receptor and the T cell antigen receptor, respectively. Now, each B or T cell expresses a unique kind of antigen receptor on its cell surface, and only one kind of antigen receptor. So each B or T cell is designed to recognize one specific type of antigen. But there are millions of B cells and T cells in our body. They are accumulated in specific organs known as lymphoid organs or lymphoid tissues. And the millions of B cells and T cells in these tissues, between them, are able to recognize almost any antigen present in the universe, even some that do not occur naturally. Now, the way in which the diversity of recognition is achieved by B cells and T cells involves a very beautiful mechanism for generating this repertoire of different receptors. And again, if we have time and the listeners are interested, we can go into that. But take it for now that the millions of B cells and T cells present in our lymphoid tissues, each lymphocyte recognizing one specific antigen. So those millions, that whole population of B cells and T cells, have the ability, the potential, to recognize almost any antigen that it might be presented with. Now, let's take an infection, for example. So during the occurrence of a bacterial infection, the innate immune system is activated, as we just learned. But during that process, fragments of the bacteria are taken by specialized cells known as dendritic cells through lymphatic channels to the local lymphoid tissues and made available for recognition by the B and T lymphocytes that are present in the lymphoid organ or lymph node. And amongst the millions of B and T lymphocytes that are present in that tissue, there will be a few, at least, that have the ability to recognize the antigens represented or carried in these bacterial fragments brought by the dendritic cells. Such lymphocytes that have the appropriate receptor will be triggered by recognition of that antigen to undergo, to proliferate initially, because those few lymphocytes by themselves will not be able to handle the infection on their own. But as a result of triggering of the antigen receptor by the appropriate antigen, the B and T cells undergo very rapid proliferation, generating what is known as a clone of B cells and T cells, each of which has the ability to recognize the antigen that initially triggered that proliferation. And that proliferation results in the generation of thousands upon thousands of these identical B and T cells. Following this phase of proliferation, which takes place over the course of about a week. The cells will now differentiate to carry out specific functions that help to eliminate the bacterial infection. In the case of B lymphocytes, the activated B cells will differentiate into a particular type of cell known as the plasma cell. And the plasma cell is specialized to release or secrete a soluble form of the antigen receptor carried by the B cell that was triggered. This secreted form of the antigen receptor on B cells is what we know as antibodies. And the antibodies then enter the circulation and go to the site of infection, where they can bind to their bacterial antigen targets and initiate events that will ultimately help to eliminate that antigen and the bacteria carrying those antigens. Similarly, T lymphocytes are also activated by the presentation of the antigen by the dendritic cells. And then the way in which T cells are activated is very different from the way B cells are activated. We don't need to get into the details right now, but the recognition of the antigen by the T cell, by the T cell receptor, again triggers proliferation, leading to the expansion of a clone of identical T cells with the same type of receptor. And then following the phase of proliferation, the T cells differentiate into different types of effector T cells, which again will migrate through the circulation back to the site of infection and carry out various functions to help eliminate the infection. So that, in a nutshell, is the adaptive phase of the immune response. And because it takes a while for this response to develop, about 7 to 14 days in total, we need this innate immune response to help control the infection while adaptive immunity is being initiated and matured. And then the B cells and T cells can migrate back, or the antibodies and T cells can get back to the infected tissue to help eliminate the infection.
Thanks for this comprehensive overview. And I would like to go back a bit to some of these details, some of the details of it. So the very first part of the of this response is that the dendritic cell presents part of the bacteria to the B and the T cells, and then proliferation happens. Can you perhaps define this term? What does it mean exactly, proliferate?
Proliferation. Mm-hmm. So proliferation means the cells divide. So one cell becomes two cells. Then each of those two daughter cells divides again. Now you have a total of four cells, and so on. So it's basically a process by which the cell replicates itself. And so as this process continues, you generate thousands and thousands of daughter cells, each of which are more or less identical to the parental cell. And most importantly, for the purposes of our discussion, the daughter cells all carry the same receptor that was initially triggered on that first B or T cell that was activated by the antigen. So it is a process of cell multiplication.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. That has clarified a lot for me and hopefully for some listeners as well. And my next question is, what is the role of these clones that you mentioned in the proliferation?
Okay, so following the phase of proliferation, you now have clones of B cells and T cells. And each clone may consist of several thousand of these daughter cells that have been generated by the proliferation. And following the phase of proliferation, each of these cells in the clone will differentiate. And when I say differentiate, what I mean is that they acquire new characteristics or properties. In the case of the B lymphocytes, the differentiation generates a particular type of cell known as the plasma cell. And you can think of plasma cells as a cell factory for producing huge quantities, millions of molecules of a soluble form of the B cell receptor for antigen. And this soluble form of the B cell antigen receptor is released into the environment outside the cell. And these released molecules are what we call antibodies. And the antibodies can then enter the circulation and go to the site of the infection, where the antibodies can bind to their microbial targets. And the binding of the antibody to the microbial antigens triggers various other events that help to eliminate or get rid of the bacteria. So that is what happens in the case of B lymphocytes. In the case of T lymphocytes, again, following the phase of proliferation, the proliferating cells will differentiate, that is, acquire new properties, and they are now called effector T cells. And there are various types of effector T cells that are distinguished by the specific functions that they can carry out. And these effector T cells will now migrate through the circulation into the site of infection, and there they will carry out the functions that they are specialized for. And that those functions can include helping other components of the immune system, including cells of the innate immune system, to help eliminate the infection. So there are two important aspects of adaptive immunity that help in the elimination of the infection. One, of course, is the generation of this large number of different clones of B and T lymphocytes, each able to recognize a distinct microbial antigen and then carry out effector functions. So you need that proliferative phase in order to generate enough cells to deal with the bacteria or other microbe that is causing the infection. The second aspect of adaptive immunity is the fact that you have very flexible functions. Depending on the kind of microbe that is being dealt with, the kinds of antibodies that are produced or the kinds of effector T cells that are generated can help in very distinct, specialized ways in order to eliminate the infection. So just to give you an example, a bacterial infection will generate certain types of antibodies and certain types of effector T cells that are most appropriate for dealing with bacteria. Whereas parasites, for instance, say a protozoan parasite like the malaria parasite, will generate different classes of antibodies and different types of effector T cells that are most appropriate for dealing with that type of pathogen. The innate immune system does not have this degree of flexibility and versatility that the adaptive immune system has. So adaptive immunity allows the generation of a very versatile, flexible type of response that is most appropriate for the kind of pathogen that is encountered. And there is a third aspect of immunity, adaptive immunity, that I don't know whether you would want to get that into that now, but that is something known as memory. We can talk about that now or later, as you wish.
I think now is a great time to elaborate on this memory.
Okay. So another very distinctive feature of adaptive immunity is the generation of what is known as immune memory. Now, I mentioned earlier that in the case of the innate immune response, the response is very stereotypic, meaning that it does not change from one encounter to another. So if the innate immune system sees a bacterial pathogen on the first encounter, it will mount exactly the same kind of response as on a subsequent encounter. Whereas the adaptive immune system, the initial encounter with a microbial or foreign antigen results in the generation of a population of memory B cells and T cells that are quite different from the population of B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes that initially encountered the antigen. So during the course of the adaptive immune response, you have the production or generation of this population of memory B and T lymphocytes that have been altered in several ways. The first way is that they are become very, very long-lived. These memory lymphocytes can sometimes survive for the whole life of a human being, 50 years or more in many cases. And so these memory B and T lymphocytes, these long-lived cells, have the same receptor, essentially, as the one that was triggered by the first lymphocytes that encountered the antigen. So that means that these memory B and T cells, they are long-lived, and they move around the circulation and the tissues constantly. So if that same antigen is ever encountered again, these memory B and T cells are available to respond quickly. The other change that occurs in memory B and T lymphocytes is that their responsiveness is greatly heightened compared to the initial or naive lymphocytes that first encountered the antigen. And this greater responsiveness means that if the same antigen is ever encountered again, the memory B and T lymphocytes are able to respond very quickly, proliferating very rapidly and acquiring their effector functions much more quickly than a naive B or T lymphocytes. And that means that the foreign antigen or the microbe can be eliminated more quickly by the memory B and T cells than by the first B and T cells to encounter the antigen. And the more quickly a microorganism is eliminated, the less opportunity it has to cause tissue damage and clinical abnormalities that manifest as disease. Okay, so the presence of memory B and T cells allows a much more rapid and heightened response compared to the naive B and T cells. And that more rapid and heightened response allows the more effective and more rapid elimination of microorganisms before they have the chance to cause pathology or damage.
So that's why there are some diseases which people can get only once in a lifetime, because at this one occasion they build memory B and T cells, and if they encounter the microbe again, which is quite probable in case of many microbes, then no disease will develop because the memory B and T cells react so quickly. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. So there are some diseases where if you have encountered the infection once, you develop these memory B and T cells that last a long time, sometimes for your entire life. And so you cannot develop disease if you encounter that same microbe again, because the microbe will be eliminated so quickly by the memory B and T cell response that it cannot cause any pathology or any disease.
And perhaps now is the right time to talk a bit about vaccines, because as far as I understand, vaccines use exactly that mechanism.
You are absolutely correct. That is exactly how vaccines work. The idea behind vaccination is that you expose the immune system, specifically the B and T lymphocytes, to a harmless form of the microorganism that you're trying to protect against. And that could be in the form of a killed form of the microorganism or an inactive form of the microorganism, or certain purified antigens derived from the microorganism. And that exposure will result in the generation of memory B and T lymphocytes, which will last for a long time, a variable period, depending on the exact vaccine that you're talking about. But what if the actual pathogen, microbial pathogen, is subsequently encountered? The memory B and T cells generated as a result of the vaccination will be able to respond quickly and enough and with sufficient magnitude that the pathogen can be eliminated before it has a chance to cause the disease that you are protected against.
That makes sense. And do I understand correctly that all these mechanisms recognize some kind of patterns, and that's why it's possible that inactive form of antigen or something which is similar to the pathogen but not exactly that can still generate B and T cells which will then be able to respond to the real pathogen as well. Is that
that is absolutely correct? So the vaccine consists of something that mimics the infection. And the mimic, as I said, can be in the form of a killed or inactivated form of the microorganism that causes the disease, or can be a purified molecule derived from that microorganism. And when you inject someone with one of these vaccine formulations, then the B and T cells will respond to the antigens present in the formulation and generate memory B and T lymphocytes. And these memory B and T lymphocytes will be circulating in the body. There will be a pool of long-lived plasma cells that secrete antibodies against the antigen in the vaccine. And so when the actual natural infection comes along, the natural pathogen comes along, the pool of preformed antibodies generated by the long-lived plasma cells, as well as the memory B and T cells, will be available to rapidly mount a response that will eliminate the pathogen before it can cause any harm.
And that's why we measure the level of antibodies after COVID vaccination, for example. So that's how we can measure how efficient the vaccination was, so to say, how many antibodies got generated.
Yes, you are correct. So most licensed vaccines currently available, the main protective mechanism, or an important protective mechanism, is mediated by the antibodies generated by the plasma cells generated that are produced during the course of the adaptive immune response. And there are populations of memory type plasma cells that reside in the bone marrow and continuously produce these antibodies. So a vaccinated individual will have increased levels of these antibodies against the antigens in the vaccine. So you are correct. So in the case of the COVID vaccine, one important indicator of protection is the level of antibodies that are generated against a specific antigen expressed by the virus causing COVID-19, and that antigen is known as the spike protein. And the virus needs the spike protein in order to infect our cells. But in a vaccinated individual, there are antibodies circulating against the spike protein. So as soon as that individual is exposed to the virus, those antibodies can bind to the spike protein and prevent the virus from infecting the cells of our body and causing disease.
And what happens if something similar but not quite the same occurs? So if a new mutant of the COVID virus appears, how do the antibodies react in that case?
That's an excellent question, and it's actually an active area of study. That is to determine how a new variant of the virus might affect the immune response that develops in an individual who has been previously vaccinated or previously exposed to the virus. And the bottom line is that the B cells retain the ability to generate antibodies against even the new variant of the virus, either as a result of modifications of the previously generated memory B cells or by the activation of completely new naive B cells, so that by a combination of these two mechanisms, you are able to generate antibodies against even the new variant, so that you will still be protected by the even in spite of the previous exposure.
Interesting. So that explains why after the COVID vaccination, perhaps you still got infected with some other type of COVID, but it was a milder infection than it.
That's correct, yes. So even in the case of reinfection by a slightly different virus, the antibodies generated by the first infection or the vaccination may still be able to react with the antigens of the second virus, even though they may be slightly different. And so those pre-existing antibodies will still provide some degree of protection. And in addition, the second virus may activate its own set of naive B lymphocytes, which can then generate plasma cells to produce antibodies specific for the second virus.
Another thing which probably many of us observed during the COVID period was that people's response to the infection varied quite a lot. So while there were some people who tested positive and didn't notice any symptoms, there were others with serious lung problems needing hospitalization, and there were also folks who experienced long COVID and long-term problems after an infection. What do we know about the reasons behind these big individual differences, not specifically about COVID, but generally?
Yes, that's also an excellent question. So speaking generally, there are appreciable differences in the way that one individual responds to a given pathogen compared to another individual. And even though that's the microorganism involved is the same, there are several reasons for this kind of inter-individual variability. One aspect of that variability is related to variations in your genes. So the genes that control the immune response are amongst the most variable in the human population. So for instance, it is very likely that at least some and perhaps many of your genes involved in controlling the immune response are different in small ways from the genes that control the immune response in me. And these variations, or polymorphisms as they are called, in the genes that control the immune response from one individual to the next, can influence the kind of immune response that develops in response to a specific pathogen. Now, this component of the variability, that is the result of genetic variations, accounts for about 40 to 50% of the variation between one individual and the next. So the remaining variability is accounted for by non-genetic factors. And these non-genetic factors can include things like your age, the environment that you are exposed to, and that includes things like the diet that you take, the exact area of your residence. Do you live in a city environment or on a farm? The kinds of pollutants that you might be exposed to. Also, there are lifestyle factors that can influence the immune response, factors such as exercise, the consumption of alcohol, cigarette smoking, and so on. So these are non-genetic factors that can also have an influence on the way your immune system responds to a specific challenge. One way in which these non-genetic factors may influence the immune system is by altering the composition of your microbiota. And the microbiota refers to the community of microorganisms, most of which are harmless and some of which are beneficial, that reside on our skin and on the surfaces of our gastrointestinal tract, respiratory tract, and genitourinary tract. These organisms, these members of the microbiota, have been shown over the last 10, 20 years or so to have a profound influence on cells of both the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. So variations in the composition of your microbiota, which can result from the kind of diet that you eat, the kind of environment where you live, the kind of things you are exposed to in your environment, including animals, smoke, pollutants, and so on, can cause variations in your microbiota. And those variations in the microbiota can in turn influence the functioning of your immune system. And so these variations in non-genetic factors, some of which have effects on the composition of your microbiota, can influence the immune system and the way it functions and add to the variability between one individual and the next in terms of how he or she responds to a specific immune challenge.
Thanks. And I encourage the readers to check out the chapter about microbiota because there are some really fascinating studies about the effects of it and what kind of things are influenced by it. And it has been really a relatively recent development, if I recall correctly, the last 20 years when it got into the focus of the mainstream. And speaking about individual variability, there is one not so cool effect of the immune system is that occasionally these immune cells recognize things which aren't pathogens, but they still regard them as target. And this is something which is fortunately affecting only some individuals, but still quite many, and mainly in the form of autoimmune diseases and allergies. So can you tell a bit more about those mechanisms?
So you are absolutely correct that in some individuals, the immune system malfunctions and either attacks components of the body that it should not recognize as being dangerous or foreign, or mount inappropriate responses to normally innocuous or harmless substances that we either consume in the diet or are exposed to in the environment. So the first type of problem in which the immune system starts to attack components of our own bodies contributes to the development of what are broadly called autoimmune or autoinflammatory diseases. And examples of such diseases are systemic lupus erythematosus, or SLE, or lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and so on. So in these diseases, either B cells, B lymphocytes, or T lymphocytes, for some unclear reasons, start to generate a response against self components or components of our own bodies. And that the activation of these self-reactive B and T lymphocytes essentially leads to the generation of an adaptive immune response against our own tissues. And that leads to various clinical abnormalities depending on the specific tissue involved. So for instance, in the case of multiple sclerosis, there are antigens in the central nervous system, the brain and the spinal cord, that are attacked by B cells and T cells, and that can cause clinical abnormalities that manifest as neurological problems. In the case of another autoinflammatory condition known as inflammatory bowel disease, that abnormal activation of adaptive immunity occurs in response to components of our microbiota. And that results in the generation of an inflammatory response in the gastrointestinal tract, manifesting as diarrhea, vomiting, fever, loss of weight, and so on. So those are the autoinflammatory or autoimmune conditions. The other broad category of diseases that you referred to are allergies. And an allergy is an abnormal immune response to harmless substances in our diet or in our environment. So normally, we do not mount an immune response to components of our diet, which is why we are able to eat all the food that we consume, because that food, of course, consists of many, many different foreign antigens. But in some individuals, there is an abnormal immune response to components of our diet. For instance, in individuals who suffer from peanut allergies, there is an abnormal immune response to antigens present in peanuts. So in such individuals, the consumption of peanuts then leads to the triggering of a very vigorous antibody-mediated response that can activate a particular type of innate immune cell known as the mast cell. And the activation of these mast cells leads to the release of various substances that can cause various clinical abnormalities. So in some cases, that can manifest as hives or little swellings on the skin. In more serious cases, you can have a more widespread activation of mast cells that can lead to a very serious condition known as anaphylactic shock, which can be life-threatening. So these are the two broad categories of inappropriate responses that can give rise to immune-mediated diseases that we hear about in the context of things that we read, or perhaps our own experiences with ourselves or our family members.
Thank you for this explanation. And as a next question, something which has perhaps come to mind to multiple listeners, that what can we do to improve all this functionality, so to increase the, so to say, good functionality of the immune system and avoid these less these negative consequences.
So I would like to emphasize to your listeners that there really is no need to boost your immune system. If you lead a healthy lifestyle, your immune system is perfectly able to take care of itself and to carry out the functions that are so important for protecting ourselves from infection. So, and the second thing I want to emphasize is that, there is no need for you to worry about your immune system, provided you are otherwise healthy and you lead a healthy lifestyle. The second thing I want to tell your listeners is that there really is no way to boost your immunity based on the products that we sometimes see advertised on TV or in the supermarket. Okay, so the various nutritional supplements and other remedies that proclaim that they have the ability to boost your immune system have no proven effect in this regard. The only validated way to boost immunity is through vaccination. And that is a very specific set of circumstances that we've talked about, where you are vaccinated against a specific microorganism and generate memory B and T cells as a result that are able to protect you if you ever see that actual pathogen. But the nutritional supplements that are sold in the supermarkets and advertised on TV, even probiotic formulations, the live microorganisms that are sometimes said to give you a more healthy microbiota, their effects are questionable. There are some studies in animals that have demonstrated benefits in experiments, and there are some very specific situations where probiotics may be helpful in preventing certain types of diseases. But as a general way to boost your immunity, such remedies, nutritional supplements or probiotics, do not have any proven benefit. So the only thing I can say in terms of helping your immune system to function is to lead a healthy lifestyle. And that includes consumption of a balanced diet, particularly a diet that is rich in fiber that promotes a healthy microbiota, and to avoid, to get the appropriate amounts of sleep, to exercise regularly, and to avoid the use of cigarettes and other forms of tobacco, and to avoid excessive alcohol consumption. If you are able to do all this and you have no other health issues, then your immune system will function in the optimal fashion. Now, of course, if you have certain health problems, such as diabetes or malnutrition, severe forms of malnutrition, then your immune system may not be functioning optimally. But the appropriate remedy there is to take care of the diabetes or the malnutrition or other problem that is secondarily affecting your immune system.
Thank you. That has been very, very interesting. And I have to admit, it is also an answer which I have to believe after seeing how complex this system is, how many different parts and different interactions it has. And we have barely just scratched the surface in this conversation. So I really encourage everyone to check out this book, because a lot of the concepts which we have discussed are also illustrated there really well. And a lot of things where we mentioned only the major concepts, you can find much more details in the book. So it's The Logic of Immunity, and it was released in January 2024 by John Hopkins University Press. And thanks a lot for both for the book and for this great conversation. And thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you very much, Rekha. It was an honor to be on your program, and I really enjoyed speaking with you.